You're listening to Security Wire Weekly, a CertSecurity.com podcast for October 22nd, 2008. This edition, an audit of the Internal Revenue Service found that it deployed two systems with known vulnerabilities. Consumer data and account information is at risk. We'll talk about the lessons learned with Jack Dennehy. Jack is Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Ounce Labs.
When it comes to analyzing a network, protecting enterprise data, or fighting malware, you can plop down thousands of dollars for a commercial product, or you can get tons of great functionality from a free tool. Let CertSecurity.com show you how some of the industry's best free and open source tools work in our exclusive screencast series. Each month, one of CertSecurity.com's best experts will offer a step-by-step video presentation showing you how to use the most powerful tools and software, including Nessus, Snort, UTM, and so much more. And it's all free. Don't wait. Watch and learn today. Visit CertSecurity.com/screencast. That's CertSecurity.com/screencast.
And we're back. An Inspector General audit is finding security problems in a $2 billion IRS computer system. The audit says the IRS deployed the system despite widespread vulnerabilities. The flaws could allow an attacker to gain access to taxpayer information without detection. They could also hamper recovery of sensitive data in an emergency. Joining me to discuss why the IRS deployed such a vulnerable system is Jack Dennehy. Jack is Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Ounce Labs. He's an expert in software security, and he's got some tips on what could be learned from this audit report. Jack, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Seems like this particular audit, it looks like it really has criticized the project steering committee, saying it failed to provide sufficient oversight. In terms of project management, especially with something like this, does it really begin with the project steering committee?
Yeah, it sort of begins and ends there, right? I mean, I think one of the most interesting parts of this IRSIG report is that the systems were accredited even though that group, the group that was actually creating the applications, knew that these two massive applications were just fundamentally flawed. Right, so not only is there some statement around the adequacy of the policies that had been in place since the beginning, you know, since I believe it was 1996 or so with CAD, or 1997 or 99 with CADE, and then 2006 with the AMS program, but that, you know, those processes themselves may have been inadequate. But for me, the thing that jumps off the page in the context of this report is the fact that those processes had captured, you know, a substantial number of problems, and they decided to let it go anyway.
That's right. There have been a number of previous audits that have discovered this, correct?
That's right. I mean, if you look within the actual detail of some of the underlying problems, these are things which in most application frameworks, whether, you know, you're thinking about a bank or a retail vendor, what have you, these are things that would typically have been caught and would have put the skids on big time. Right, you've got things, you know, as fundamental as not encrypting backup data, right, as allowing development teams to use real live taxpayer data, your data and my data, as part of their testing jigs, right, a lack of any sort of insight into who's doing what inside these systems once they're up and running. And so I think that it is a combination of all of these factors over the course of time that sort of leads you to the conclusion that the IG's report comes to, which is it's really quite surprising that they would decide to deploy this anyway in this sort of cascading wave of difficulty.
Now, this project steering committee did have some IT security pros involved who actually recommended that the system owners accept the risks associated with the vulnerabilities. So they did have somebody consulting with them who said that, you know, we should move forward and accept these risks.
You know, I think that, as in anything else, security exists along a continuum, right? No one is ever perfectly secure, nor is there ever an application that is so insecure it's not useful somewhere. And so I think that, you know, subject matter experts can always agree to differ on things. the thing that strikes me about this is that some of the areas that they decided to assume risk in are areas where you're simply not allowed to assume that risk when you're dealing with things like credit card data. And as an individual who has both credit card data and an income tax return, I'm personally more concerned that my income tax return gets out than does my credit card data. It's much more damaging to me in terms of information and identity theft. So the net for me is if it's completely inappropriate to ever allow, as an example, my credit card number to be stored, you know, long-term in an application test jig, as an example, then I think it would be equally inappropriate, almost under any circumstance, to allow that same level of detail, i.e. my tax return data, to exist inside test jigs inside these development groups. And there's a second piece of this that makes me very uncomfortable, which is that the CADE application, which is the big, here's all your taxpayer data, is the first, you know, the first one that they looked at, and they found a series of problems within it that are well laid out inside the report. Difficult for me is that the second application they looked at, AMS, appears to be the controlling function over CADE, and it was equally found to have a series of these difficulties within it. So not only is the underlying application flawed in meaningful ways, but the application you're going to look to control it and reconfigure it, you know, lacks some basic underlying mitigating controls itself that would make it, you know, reasonably secure. So it's difficult to understand where the security would be introduced into this ecosystem, you know, if it's not in the basic program, nor is it in the controlling program that oversees it.
What happened here? Is it a factor of you're on this timeline, you have a certain amount budgeted for this particular project, and you're really under the gun to get it done no matter what?
You know, it appears from the commentary that exists inside the report that there is a series of prevailing pressures that exist upon these major programs where funding events are tied to milestones. And clearing those milestones, you know, clearing those stage gates ends up forcing sometimes an acceptance of risk in order to get to the next, you know, chunk of funding, which may in fact give you enough funding to correct the risk, perhaps ideally. I am not familiar enough with this particular procurement to sort of make any value judgment as to whether or not that was the only underlying cause or whether there was some other external influence that came into play. But from what I can read inside this report, it appears as though the sort of the architecture of the funding was one of the things which put an additional amount of pressure and urgency on the acceptance of some of these risks.
Tie this for a second to the private sector. Obviously, we're talking about a government agency here, but are there projects in the private sector that also come under the same financial pressures?
I mean, as a fellow who's, you know, had the good fortune to run a couple of his own software companies, and I also had the good fortune to work with some really large major software providers, that pressure hits you in the head every day, right? You know, whether it is here within the public sector where a financing event, the acceptance of funding is predicated upon a milestone release, you know, recognize that a software company, you know, particularly a small and mid-sized software company that misses a release is missing revenue, right, is missing the lifeblood of how it runs, that perhaps an external agency which is doing retail transactions, if they can't spin out the new version of what they've got, they're not going to be taking those transactions inbound. So I don't believe that this pressure is unique to the public sector. I do believe that the capacity to sort of accept this risk without the really understandable and we've seen referenceable risk that happens in the private sector, i.e. customer loss, lawsuit, etc., is something which may create a slightly different weighting system for the amount of risk versus the amount of capacity to accept that risk.
Is it clear here in the IRS's case, are they outsourcing any part of this development process?
You know, it's not clear. It largely refers to this, and I think it's constructive to do it this way. They largely refer to it in the context of the actual artifact itself. Was the artifact as it was meant to be deployed, you know, treated in a certain way? And there isn't a lot of insight given as to what the sources were for the various pieces that came out.
Yeah.
One thing just, you know, specifically related to that relationship between what I know and what I don't know is the fact that one of the things that was called out was that there was actually no checks done of the interconnecting agencies, right? So, you know, that in private data sharing in general, right, in the old, if you remember what went on with HIPAA, there was a lot of talk about business agents and business relationships and who you could share data with and who you couldn't and how much data you could share. But one of the things that was called out here, and it's perhaps a little less glossy so people didn't call it out as much, you know, in the way in which they described this report, but there were no interconnection security agreements in place. So as this system would have to share information with other pieces of the IRS or with other agencies, there were no basically, there were no policies called out that said, well, you can only look at this much data, or you can only share this data. If you agree, you'll treat it in a very specific and secure way. And again, when you think about the fact that this is an enormous amount of data, right? By my tally, based on the numbers they gave, the CADE system in 2007 processed 28.4 billion returns. And so that's a ton of data. And if I don't have relationship agreements with the people who will take the data from me and use it for various purposes, then that is just an explosion, right? An exponential explosion on what is already a massive data set.
Obviously, the IRS works with a lot of contractors. And in this case, one of the findings was that contractors working for the IRS can make configuration changes without prior notice or approval. And that was a big red flag. Wouldn't it really gum up the works, or is there an easier way for them to actually put some sort of checks in place to allow contractors to make changes, but with some sort of oversight?
Sure. I mean, I think that if you look at any, again, we'll treat financial services institutions because they're the same, and you look at major database providers, you know, people, you know, that create database applications, typically that audit function is massively important, right? I want to know who just decided to drag 50% of my savings account balance out and put it someplace else. So that audit function, that capacity to audit, whether we're talking about a change to the software or a change to the underlying data sets, is a natural part of almost any work that's done in terms of major database applications. I mean, I've seen it everywhere, and I think that most people have. So I don't think it is necessarily, you know, sort of sand in the gears of getting the job done. I think what ends up happening is if you're in a rush to get an application together and, you know, on Wednesday somebody says, oh, by the way, Jack, I need for you to also put in this new function, that job gets much more difficult if I not only have to put in that piece of functionality, but then tie it into the audit and control system, right? Because now it's not just, you know, move column A to column B. Now it's authenticate myself, record who I am, put a timestamp on it, move column A to column B, create a backing store so I can roll it back if it's screwed up, record the fact that it's done, and send the report off someplace. As you can see, sort of by that sort of trivial example, the work that's necessary from a sort of a development perspective to create this robust source of control and audit information is more costly than it is to just sort of slipshod drive it out the door. And so I think that in what appears to be, you know, a very big, very important application that's rolling, you know, with great inertia towards delivery dates, it's very likely that a lot of those control functions, a lot of those audit functions didn't get implemented simply because they get tossed off the bus because it was more important to get the basic functionality in there.
Let's talk about the software development process for a moment. You mentioned costs, and is there a way to move through the software, put security into the software development process with a minimum of cost? I mean, that's what you consistently hear, is that it's just so costly to build in security.
You know, it's interesting. In 2004, as we at OnSlabs were trying to think about how we could help people do a better job of securing outsourced projects, I put together some contract language with a large law firm here on the East Coast that reserved the right for organizations to test for security. And as we're putting together, being a small company, I was afraid that the outsourcers would really hate us. And so I went wandering around talking to them. And the universal response from them was that it was much more expensive to find out after the fact that the thing was insecure. So basically, if they got this requirement for a new piece of development and they performed the development according to the requirements and afterwards some sort of user acceptance test was done and it turned out it wasn't secure enough, right, by some sort of amorphous definition of secure enough, it wasn't really called out in the original scoping of the job, then what ended up happening was there was a major fist fight, right? Who's responsible for the fact that this isn't secure? Is it the responsibility of the requester because they didn't do a good enough job of specifying what it was? Or is it the job of the fulfillment organization because they should have just known what secure meant, right? And so from my perspective, with the experience we've had across hundreds of companies in the way in which they do the development, that exercise of calling it out up front, what did I mean by secure, can actually end up saving a ton of money. And perhaps more importantly, particularly in a case where milestones are important like this, it can save you a ton of time, right? Because nobody is delivering their software 3 months early just in case something pops up, right? The reality of software development is you're jamming like crazy until you reach the end of the time when you're not allowed to jam anymore. And so if part of what you're working on during that compressed period of time is also the fulfillment of these security requirements, then it's much, much, much less likely that when you hit the end of the day, you're going to be forced with one of these horrible decisions between, all right, do I tell somebody we're going to be 3 months late, or do I actually just accept this risky software and pretend it's not as risky as I know that it is? Right, so this is sort of the conundrum that one's placed in. And so is it really that expensive, particularly where you're building something, you know, largely from requirements from scratch, to make it more secure from the beginning? I don't really think it is. I mean, there are additional problems, of course, with some legacy systems, you know, going back and reworking established pieces. But I think that it's not that much more expensive to get it done in this way. And frankly, at the end of the day, it ends up being a real optimizer, saving you a ton of time later on, because security vulnerabilities tend not to pop up in a nice organized way, right? You find a security vulnerability in a bad way, i.e. something leaks out where it shouldn't have, well, then you can fix that one little hole, but then you've got to start wondering, and you'll start finding out pretty quickly where the rest of the holes are. And if the application hasn't been constructed from the beginning in a very secure way, or at least a reasonably secure way, those things are popping up onesie-twosie, and the cost of remedium is just devastating.
In your opinion, and then, the onus is on the company in the scope of the project, so it's on the company that's hiring the outsourcer to make sure that security is built into the scope, project scope.
Yeah, I think it's the responsibility, just to be clear, I think it's their responsibility to describe, you know, at a sufficient level of detail what they want, and it's their right, more than the responsibility, to check that that was done when it comes across the transom. And then it is the job of the people that they hire to fulfill those requirements. In the same way, if I, you know, ask for something to be built at my house, I'm responsible for saying what color it is and how many windows it has, and it's the construction person's job for giving me, a piece of my house that meets those requirements. And then the building inspector helps me as the user to be certain that I've gotten what I was supposed to get, and that those criteria have been met in a way that may not be necessarily visible to me. So I do believe it's the right and responsibility of the acquirer to make sure that the thing is well described and then, you know, well validated.
Is there any oversight yet over the software development industry for the outsourcers?
None that I know of. I mean, we've had a ton of work going on inside our industry. You know, Alan Powler and the guys at SANS are doing a great job of creating a curriculum and certification process for helping people to learn how to write more secure code. We've done a lot of work, you know, in a variety of open source community activities and in working with our own clients and in speaking nationally, you know, on the issue of creating contract language, which reserves for you the right to make sure that the application which you acquire is secure enough for your purposes. And, you know, major software providers, you know, people like the Microsofts have implemented their own secure development life cycles for the purposes of trying to build more and better secure code. So I think that there is this grassroots, if you will, effort to improve this. But I think that because software development is so different from shop to shop, that the languages that people use are so different, and the purposes to which these applications are put are so different, it's hard to come up with a single set of criteria that would adequately measure everybody's security without putting an unreasonable burden of security on applications which aren't as critical.
I see your point. So are there any warning signs then when you're going to hire a software developer to work on a particular project? Is there any warning signs there that you may be stepping into something here where you're going to get some shoddy work?
Yeah, my first early warning detector is when I tell them I'm going to reserve the right to audit their code and they say that's a deal breaker, then let it be a deal breaker. Right, an organization which won't let you look under the covers at the software they're delivering to you is an organization that's afraid of what you're going to find. You know, it has long been my belief that some of my best customers over the course of time have been the ones who put me through the ringer the most in terms of understanding how I built, what I've built, and how it'll suit their purposes. So my current early warning system, because of the immaturity of some of this requirement space, is that if someone pushes back hard against you requesting that they develop code securely and then let you check their work, then you're probably going to end up having a problem.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcast by going to our podcast landing page at certsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at certsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.